Welcome to episode 9 of season 2 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And namaste, konnichiwa, and buongiorno for me, Greg the Film Watcher.
Yeah, that's right. So going on from that, we're going to be talking about three culturally different films here. We're looking at an Indian film, Monsoon Wedding. We're looking at an Japanese film called Afterlife, and also an Italian film called Remember Me.
So we're looking at films from across different cultures, but when we sat down and watched these films, we realised that they're all dealing with really big themes. So this episode is called Love and the Great Hereafter, to tell you about those themes, but hopefully that'll make a bit more sense as we go along.
That's right.
So, Ricardo, why don't we get started, and why don't you tell us about Monsoon Wedding?
Okay, Monsoon Wedding. Directed by Meera Nair, this hit 2001 film begins with Father Lalit Verma, Nasiruddin Shah, who is doing his very best to organise a huge wedding for his daughter, who has been arranged to marry someone she's only known for a few weeks. Lalit is quite stressed by it all, as all the family come to celebrate it, not only from India, but from across the world. His daughter, the bride, Aditi Verma, Vasundhara Das, is in two minds and quite anxious since she's been having an affair with her ex-boss Vikram, Samir Aira. Around the fun of organising this event, the film weaves out other multiple stories within the family which add dramatic complexity to this film. There's the bride's cousin, Rhea Verma, Shefali Shetty, who was sexually abused by her uncle and finally gets to speak out about what happened to her to prevent the abuse of another young girl in the family. Then there's the wedding contractor, PK Dubey, a hilarious Vijay Raz, who falls in love with the family's maid, Alice. The bride's young, effeminate brother who wants to become a chef, who struggles with his father's disapproval. And then there's Ayesha, the youngest relative of the bride, who flirts with the bride's cousin, Rayal, who's just returned from Melbourne. Now, most films at the time were being filmed on 35mm film. This film was shot on Super 16mm, a smaller frame, and was shot mostly with handheld cameras, which is not overdone, though, capturing subtle, expressive performances from its large cast. There's a lot going on here, and it's all wonderful to watch. As the drama unfolds, there's always light and colour, and boy, does this film have colour. Meera Nair said that Monsoon Wedding was a portrait of modern contemporary India, a very personal story about her kind of people, Punjabi people, a community that works hard, parties hard, and has a huge appetite for life. Well, I've never travelled to India, but if that was her intention, I believe her. And I think she's captured this perfectly here. And it makes me want to go there. Greg, what are your thoughts?
Well, I want to have a moment's silence just now to admire the way you rattled off those names, because you know I'm really bad at that.
But so, I've tried.
Oh, no, I think you've done better than tried. I think that, I am seriously impressed. I just can't do it.
I think they all sound a little bit Italian.
Yeah, it was a bit Italian, but anyway. So, look, I like this film.
Yeah.
I've seen it before. I think you've seen it before too.
Yeah, I had. But a long time ago.
I actually couldn't remember much at all about the story.
I actually watched this on VHS.
Yeah. I thought I was the old one. Anyway, there's a lot going on in here, and I kept thinking about two films, apart from Monsoon Wedding itself. I kept thinking about Bride and Prejudice, just because of the similarity of, you know, the daughter and, her, in this case, her cousins, but the young one in the house and the suitors and the setting. But I also found myself thinking of Love Actually, of all these different stories about different sorts of love, as you say, all woven under the same roof, unlike Love Actually.
Yeah, I thought exactly the same thing, actually.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I really thought the same thing when I was watching it. I thought, this is not dissimilar to Love Actually because of all the different types of love in this film.
So you've got parent love, you've got the father who not only is stressed out about the wedding, but also having that kind of melancholy that his children are growing up and will leave him one day and the daughter's about to go to America. You have the arranged marriage where the two people actually discover that they probably do like each other and are happy to get married. You have the first love, the falling in love of the young cousin and the guy from Australia. And it was so odd hearing an Australian accent in the middle of all
I know,
of this as well.
I know, wasn't it?
Because he started speaking, I was thinking, is that an Aussie? It was.
He actually did that well.
He lived in Melbourne for a while, yes. I looked that up. I was so startled. But you've also got, and I want to use the word love here extremely loosely, the dark love of the paedophile.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not love, you know, it's a perversion, but it's a different part of it and something that I don't know why, I had totally forgotten was in the storyline.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that too.
And I was really struck by his performance because I actually thought at first, the way the film starts, you're just overwhelmed with colour and noise and music and all these different characters. And even the groom says, who's the arranged marriage groom, who's meeting this extended family, some of whom have come from America as well, he says, I just don't know who's who. And I felt like that. That's just... had to let it wash over me and hope it would all start to settle, which it did.
That's the point of it, though.
I think it is.
It just thrusts you into this world and you go, this is what it's like.
Okay, and you're moving between different languages. English, Hindi, I think it is.
No, there's Punjabi, Hindi and English,
Okay, all right. Yeah. I didn't realise there were three languages.
Yeah, there was three languages.
And there are people with telling looks. And so when the... what's the cousin's name? Is it Rhea?
Rhea.
When Rhea is looking at her uncle's brother-in-law... and exchanging looks, I thought, oh, this must be an old love story. I'd totally forgotten that, in fact, he had abused her when she was younger. But in the midst of all this chaos, you do get a sense of there are these things that are going on you don't understand yet. And I was totally oblivious to the fact that a lot of this was filmed on handheld cameras, which is a testament to the craft, because sometimes handheld cameras, it's so obvious and you feel a bit ill or distracted.
Well,
it was so well done.
We've done films about Lars von Trier before and he uses handheld cameras, very much digital, but handheld cameras, it can be overdone quite a lot, and they don't overdo it here. And so you really don't realise it, you don't recognise it, but it does capture the movement of the piece. I think it's very well done.
Yes, and I loved the film more than I remembered loving it. I even liked... Did you see the joke in the end titles?
No.
So at one point, the wedding planner, is it Duvet? Is that his name? Duvet?
Yeah, PK.
He says to the father of the bride, who's paying for him, at one point he says, it'll be 10 minutes exactly and approximately, which is a nice little turn of phrase. And then in the final titles, it says, we are like that, only 40 locations, 30 days, exactly and approximately.
Yeah, right.
And the fact it was making this little self-referential joke in the titles, that playfulness, and it is a very playful film, but with this very dark undercurrent going all the way through.
Yeah. In terms of Bollywood cinema to American cinema, I think that this is not Bollywood. I wouldn't call this film
Bollywood
film. So, and it doesn't sort of... surprise me here, because Mira pitched this to film financiers as an American independent-style film made in India, which makes sense after watching it. I mean, unlike other Bollywood wedding films or musicals, which are like fantasies, okay, the drama and sentimentality of this film does feel like an Indian-American co-production film. It does. It really does remind me of that, so it doesn't really surprise me there. I mean, it doesn't really surprise me as well. I mean, Mira lived in India till she was 19, then moved to America to study, so... it doesn't surprise me either, but I think the meshing or the coming together of those two cultures in this one movie has been great.
But we do see that in Pride and Prejudice too. It's what I think I understand.
Well, Gurinder Chadha does the same sort of thing.
To be a phenomenon, which is that when someone gets married back in the home country, India, relatives come from places like England and America who have been successful, ideally, but they all come home and it's just a big reunion. And this becomes the device to have all these plots about people who now are suddenly together who aren't ordinarily, and things coming out of the past as well.
It's the drama as well, the father and his relationship with his wife and whatnot as well.
And the wedding planner.
And his relationship with his kids.
There were parts, as some of the stories reach their kind of, culmination towards the end, I found myself in tears a number of times of happiness tears.
Yeah.
And I'm a sucker for these things, often in musicals, but not in this film, it's not a musical, obviously. But I'm a sucker for where people kind of come together and communities formed and people, value each other. Just like the ending of the beautiful It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
Which, I always cry at.
Of course.
I felt it was like that towards the end of this film as well. I love the dance scene that's going on. Even as a Bollywood film, the dancing at the wedding party.
Yeah, it comes to the choice of music as well in this movie. There's quite a few different styles of music here. It's like almost hip-hop and folk at the same time. There's quite a different...
Hip-hop and folk? Yeah. I'm going to have to go and think about that.
That's what I got out of it anyway.
My one critique of this film is the character of the bride. I just find her so passive, like everything's happening around her. And I don't know if that was meant to be what the character was like, but I just felt like, I just wish she had a bit more grit or gumption or something. I got a bit bored with her.
Really?
Her story, yeah. It was all the stories around her and even to a degree of story about her groom that I found interesting. I just sort of thought, I wanted her to be more.
Yeah.
And she's the bride. The bride's a central character in a wedding film.
Yeah, she is.
I just felt a bit let down by that.
I think the story of Rhea, the cousin there, was a lot stronger. I think there's a few stories there which you did warm to a lot more. I think, I do agree with you, actually, with that. The story of her with the affair and whatnot has been done before. We've seen that before.
The one thing I really loved about this film, and again, I don't remember from last time, is the sensuality.
Mm.
Most of the time, that sensuality is around the wedding planner and the maid who are falling in love.
Yeah, which is a lovely story.
Oh, it is. And the things you see like that, the moment that he falls in love, when it's raining marigolds on him and he starts to eat one of those.
Eat one of them, yeah.
The candlelight in the shed when the power fails and he goes out to try and fix it and gets shown up.
Yeah.
When he gives her his business card and she tucks it into her sari.
Mm.
When she's trying on the jewellery, when she thinks no one's watching her. The marigold heart, the marigold umbrella on the bridge in the rain. It was all beautifully done. Mm. But also, I think Mira Nair really knows how to film a kiss.
Mm.
Not just between the wedding planner and the maid, but when the cousin, the young cousin and the Australian guy first kiss.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's beautifully done. And it was erotic. You know, it was sensually erotic. Yeah. And when we talk about Remember Me, the Italian film, which I would naively assume would be great at filming kisses, because I'd seen Monsoon Wedding first, and so they were compared in my mind, I didn't get that sense at all, but this was just so beautifully done.
Yeah, it was. I mean, cinematography-wise, it was beautiful, but I think the costumes also lend itself to the cinematography massively as well, because the costumes are just so beautiful and colourful and bright. And it's joyous. It's a joyous, wonderful, beautifully made movie.
But with that undertone of dread as you start to realise about the pedophilic uncle.
Yeah, well, this is what I like about it. It's like you're looking backstage on a Bollywood film, of the sort of fantasy of a Bollywood film. Just the undercurrent, which she shows up, and it's very riveting to watch.
Yes, and his performance was masterful. So even the way
the dad?
The pedophile brother-in-law.
Oh, yeah.
The way... Oh, the dad was good too, don't get me wrong. But the way that his hair and his, I think his makeup, he looked like he was made of plastic.
Mm.
And the way he moved and the way he was
his
just there,
eyes, his eyes were very, they were very kind of dead. Yeah, they were. Yeah.
And I checked, this guy was born exactly, the actor was born exactly 1 year before me. So at that stage, he was 40 and yet he looks so much older.
He does. He looks very old.
Yeah. And I've seen photos of him since. He looks nothing like that character. Mm. But I want to say the visual design of him, you know, the hair and makeup and his acting. Yeah, it's a brave part to take on because you really dread and hate him.
You do.
Yeah. So it's a brave portrayal, but he does it so well.
Any portrayal of that character is very brave to take on because, you know, for an actor, especially because there is a, you know, you can be typecast as that person because people hate you on screen and so they just remember you as this awful character. It's happened to a few actors.
Well, or the actor is tempted to either overreg it, to kind of go down almost the hysteria path, or to make it all almost ironic. And, you know, I'm not really like this, but I'm playing this character.
Well, when they play it so convincingly, it's quite scary. I think there was an actor in, I forget his name actually, but he was in Happiness, the Todd Solondz film.
Which I don't think I've seen.
He's a scary character in that. But, he's been in other films, but it's... Every time I see him, I think of the pedophile in Happiness. I can't help it. It's just because it's this strong portrayal. Of course, you just hate those characters, so you invest a lot into them.
So, overall, what did you think?
I'm giving this an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, snap, me too.
Mm.
It's just, it's not a great film, and I'm a bit surprised that I just didn't remember it terribly well. I think I remember the colour and the movement rather than the story.
Yeah, actually, me too. That's the thing. When I remembered
back
in it.
But I will now.
Yeah, now I will. But back then, I remember before I watched it again was colour, movement, wedding.
trying to make sense of who all the characters were at the start.
Yeah, yeah.
But look, it's very well done.
It does move me.
It moves me too, and I wasn't expecting that.
And it moves beautifully. I can't think of a scene in there which I wouldn't want to have in there. You know,
my one critique is the bride.
Yeah. Mm.
That's why it's not a higher rating, I think, overall. But it's a very well done film. And whether you're into Bollywood or not, you know, or think of this as being a Bollywood film, which as Ricardo says it's not, I really recommend seeing it.
Well, it's a bit of a hybrid between American and Indian, I think, and it really does toe the line of both. So the next film we're going to discuss is the Japanese film Afterlife. Greg, take us away with That one.
Arigato. This 1998 film begins in a drab and run-down building, in the middle of an autumnal mist, perhaps we're in some kind of government agency. There are five caseworkers who come in to start the week, to be briefed on their caseload, with whom they need to work so that they can move on. Gradually, these 22 people emerge out of the mist to await their caseworker. So far, so ordinary. But we quickly learn that we're in the waiting room between death and eternity, in what some cultures call limbo. The recently dead are here to prepare, guided by their case manager over 3 days as they select their one meaningful or precious memory, which they'll then retain for eternity while forgetting all else. Part of the joy of this film is the different reactions of the different people. Some remember simple and more profound pleasures, sights, sounds, tastes, or simply the breeze on their face. Some remember others' acts of kindness. And others struggle to find anything of meaning in their lives, or simply refuse to choose. Some of these interviews were scripted by the writer-director Hirokazu Koreeda, but many were impromptu, with real people, not actors, reminiscing about their own lives. But I couldn't tell you which was which. The dead then collaborate in filmed recreations of their memory, which are then watched in a theatrette, witnessing their memory and then vanishing into eternity. This is both a whimsical and profound film. It leaves you wondering what your one memory would be. Ricardo, what did you think of the film?
It does do that. It does lead you to think that way at the end of it, I must say. However, I was quite bored by this, Greg. Okay, hang on a minute. I love the premise, okay, of it, and of course the afterlife is quite a, you know, an amazing topic. But however, I think it went on for way too long. I think I was really invested in the characters of the people who work at the station, okay? And I think there were too many stories, too many characters telling their stories. And I found, look, after watching Monsoon Wedding, which is directed with quite a lot of flair, you look at Recordarte Me, which we'll talk about, Remember Me, which is directed with quite a lot of flair, I found this was quite boringly shot, okay? And I found it all very drab. Who would want to be in this afterlife? This is really drab and a bit boring. I was liking some bits, and don't get me wrong, I did like some moments. I don't know about the recreation of the memories. How you're getting other dead people in limbo, recreating memories from just so they can go, but you're staying in limbo. I don't know. I found it quite odd.
So let's go straight to the scores.
Hang on. No, but it was an interesting film. This is the thing. I want to discuss it with you because I felt it was an interesting film. I didn't hate it. It was nearly 2 hours. I felt like I could have been an hour and a half, and it would have been tighter. And I would have got it because I was getting it. All the other stories they were telling, it felt like When Harry Met Sally. They were just telling all these stories in between Harry Met Sally's
stories. This film is nothing like When Harry Met Sally. Have you seen When Harry Met Sally?
Hang on a minute. And then it's the bits in between when they're saying about their wedding stories.
I respected your opinion until about, 45 seconds ago.
Hang on a minute.
I used to like you.
Sorry.
Go on. I'm not entirely allergic to your opinion, actually.
But
do go on and
okay,
on.
Okay,
on.
Okay, okay. You know, there's one section in there where the guy says, I was happy yesterday because I thought about this. But yesterday he wasn't that happy. The guy was sitting there with a drab look on his face thinking about something, which is a lot of shots of them thinking. Just thinking. Oh, they're thinking about something. Oh, what are they thinking now? And there's no music, hardly any music in it, nothing at all. I just thought it was a little bit blur.
Why did you want music?
Well, I don't know, just something. I just felt it was just, I don't know. It just wasn't grabbing me. There were some great moments in there where suddenly I was finding out something about one of the characters in there, how his relationship with another older character. I love one moment when the young guy says, well, that's something of our generation. And the older guy says, hang on a minute, our generation, you know, and he says, well, I was born in 1922 and I died in the war and we are pretty much the same age. But that story was great. And I was really quite moved by that story, especially when you find out, I won't say exactly what it is, but you find out why their relationship is so special and why he's having trouble interviewing that character.
They have a connection that neither of them realise going into it.
That's right. And that was great. So there are amazing moments in here. I didn't understand the girl and what her issues were really in it.
The caseworker?
Yeah. I didn't really get why she was, you know, suddenly upset in the snow. I'm not going to say too much as well because I don't want to give away any spoilers because there are some spoilers in here I don't want to give away. But this is my point of it. I love the premise and I was really into it when I started watching it. I thought, this is going to be great. I'm going to love this. And I love some of the cinematography in it. I loved the train station and whatnot. I thought that was great. Then coming into the sort of Grand Central Station sort of look. I think it looked like a station.
I don't remember that at all. Did we watch the same film?
Yeah. It looks like a train station. It reminded me of a train station anyway. It looked like it's sort of at the very beginning when all of the dead people are supposedly coming in and they're going to the...
Oh, out of the mist.
Yeah, out of the mist.
Into the hall.
Yeah.
The waiting room. Oh, okay.
That reminded me of a station.
I suddenly thought we'd seen different editions.
No, it reminded me of a station.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No,
it's just what I got from it anyway.
It's just this, you're right. It's drab. It's this drab building in the middle of the autumnal mist, and the people coming. Oh, you must have thought it was smoke, like a station. It was mist.
It was mist. I know it was mist.
On the Monday morning. Yeah. And the fact that people coming out of the mist and as shadows and then announcing themselves at the front desk, to me, was really visually effective.
It was.
And I thought, oh, maybe it's always like this, but then you hear characters talking about the cherry blossom in springtime and they do have seasons. But it's a very deliberately drab, run-down, surprising kind of place to turn up to on the way to eternity. But, you know, I think that's deliberate. This film was shot on a shoestring budget, I think, so part of it might have been driven by pragmatics, but I don't care. I think the look of the place is so unexpected and like some kind of almost forgotten government agency that's doing something really profound with people, you know, after you've died and moved on, and preparing you for something very profound.
Well, I was glad it answered.
I like that juxtaposition.
Yeah. It answered some questions as to what I was thinking. Why are the workers in this building? Why aren't they moving on? It does answer those questions, which is great.
It does for two or three of the five, yeah.
Yeah, I understood it. I understand what I were getting at with the little stories of moments, of cherry blossoms, of what you loved about, you know, this one moment in your life and choosing one moment in your life to remember for eternity. But then I just thought, well, why that premise that you're going to be reliving that for eternity? It's like you're watching a 1 or 10 second film forever.
Yeah, but look,
really?
No, I think the idea is that you're forever in a moment of bliss. It's not. I don't see the movie part of it. And look, let me tell you about my response to this film. Both times I watched it, I suggested this film. I saw it years ago one night on for those who. In Australia, SBS TV, which is our multicultural world television station here. Just caught it one night. I think I recorded by mistake. And I just loved it. And the reason I loved it was I was so taken, I think, by that concept of isolating that one moment in your life. And it made me think about it. And I've worked out what my one moment is. That to me, is something of a gift of the film.
Yeah, and it is. It is.
Did you work out your moment?
No.
Okay. So mine involved a pig, a pineapple, and a seesaw, but we don't go into that more seriously. That's actually obviously a lie. And I love the concept of it, and I don't remember it being a two-hour film. So when I picked it up to watch it this week, I was quite surprised by how long it is. And this is a slow, and I would argue, a meditative film. Now, I made a mistake this time. I watched it. I was very tired, and I have to say I did start to nod off a couple of times, but that's because
I nodded off quite a few times.
But I was in the wrong state for that, and I know you've been a bit tired lately as well. So I think we have to take that with a grain of salt. This is not a film, folks, to watch when you're tired.
No,
but second time around, there are so many little things I started to pick up on it. Now you're right; you can really pick the logic of this film apart.
You can,
and it will the thread will give very, very quickly. You know. Things like, where do these videos come of your life? Where's one video for each year of your life? Why are they on video? What happens 20 years later when now everything's streamed or digital? You know, do they have digital ones?
Exactly.
Just things like that. Yeah. And
but also, if you've got videos of of 1 year of your life, all these videos of your life, why are they recreating?
Well, that was my next. The next thing I was going to say. Why do they have to film it if they already have it captured?
That's right.
But I think it's because what they're doing is not recreating the physical actuality; they are recreating the person's perception of that memory.
Yeah.
And so you see the dead person collaborating on recreating that moment. So you see the pilot whose moment was flying through the clouds, talking about how important it was where the wing was with regard to the cockpit and what the clouds looked like. See, and he sees he helps them work out how to execute that with cotton balls and so on.
Yeah, see, I liked the fact that when he was showing them what the wings were like and everything like that on the plane, but in terms of the executing it in the actual filmmaking of it, I found that completely boring. I just wasn't taken by the actual... I think all that went on too long. Them trying to work out how to do the cloud.
No, see, this...
Come on.
No, this time around, I think I got it a lot more.
Really?
Because there was a moment in the film that I was totally oblivious to last time around. So, you know how at one stage the caseworker who has this relationship with the older guy, the caseworker who died when he's 22 in the war, he is walking on the corridor at one stage and he looks up and he sees the moon through a skylight.
Yeah.
This is how beautiful it is. And then someone else notices that same thing. And after he's gone, do you remember what happens?
Yes, I do.
And what do you think that means?
I don't know what that means.
I think I do. So what happens, obviously for those who haven't seen the film, is it turns out that this full and crescent moon that is seen at different times against the night sky is actually a cutout
on top of
the window. And here's my theory. I think what that's trying to say is it doesn't matter in fact what that moment actually was. What matters is that you found beauty and meaning in that moment, and that's what's important, not the actuality. And so the video... So I this time around, I really puzzled about why would they recreate these moments on film if they've already got them captured, because what they got captured is the real thing.
Yeah.
And what you are really recreating for all of eternity, for your moment of bliss, is your perception and memory and attributed value and meaning to that moment. And so the guy who really struggles to pick his moment, who has the connection with the 1922 caseworker, his moment... You find, again, I want to be careful what we say here, but his moment, you find out that he has created, was actually his wife in that moment.
That's right.
And that you find out she had died sometime previously. You find out what her moment was, and even though it was in the same place, it was a different moment, had much more different meaning to her. So what was really valuable to him may or may not have been valuable and meaningful to her, but that was the thing that meant something to him. And I think that's, I don't want to, you know, overreach here, but I think on this second viewing, that's what the moon... little bit.
Yeah, because I was wondering about that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there were other things that left me scratching my head. I don't remember noticing before that the place, the agency, has a logo.
It does have a logo, yeah.
That you see a few times. You see it on a flag a number of times. You see it on some of the uniforms that looks almost like two interlinked circles.
It does, yeah.
And it almost looks like the word go, I noticed as well.
Oh, I didn't notice
in
that.
In a very stylistic way.
Yeah.
Again, that might just be me. It could well be. But... I don't understand why the logo was so important and whether there's another level of meaning there.
For a film which is shot so statically, and it really is shot very statically, and it doesn't move that much, it really allows in certain shots to just linger on the performances and not cut, which is fine.
There were some odd cuts in some of those scenes as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. But I think that's fine. I think that all that is fine if you... in the editing room, know when you should cut and know what is enough.
I get that. I do get that.
It's an editing thing for me. It's a filmmaker thing.
I think it could be tighter, but I'm not sure.
That's a filmmaker thing for me, though. I think I know in the editing room, I think sometimes the director can obviously love the work so much that they just don't want to cut out bits that they really love. And I think, you know, sometimes it takes somebody really quite brave to just go, it's not needed, get rid of it to move the story along. I think some directors can get, you know, overall by what their work is and their process. And did he write that? I'm not sure.
He did write it. And I was going to say, I think that often, I've said to you before, when it's a writer-director and there's no one saying, hang on a second, think about this.
Yeah.
Look, I'm not sure what I would cut out of it. Like, you would cut out, I think, a lot of those, you know, filmmaking sequences.
So, I'd cut them down, but also cut down some of the stories as well.
But I think it was trying to make the point, as I say, that they were helping shape what their perception of the memory would be going forward. I think the word that for me characterizes, well, I guess two words. The first word is meditative, and for some people that will be slow or even boring, and that's fine. And so I struggled a bit this time just because I was tired. I've just picked the wrong time to watch it.
Yeah,
I'd like to watch this film actually in an audience.
You know, that
communal kind of experience. Yeah. I read of some viewings where people clapped at the end. I think that'd be an interesting thing to be part of.
Yeah,
but the second word I would pick out of this is whimsy. There is a nice sense of whimsy.
There is whimsy.
So when people are brought in for their initial briefing and they explain, you know, why they're there and the process, and they say, yeah, now that you've died, and they say, oh, and I'm sorry for your loss. Now, that's what you normally say to the survivors. They say it to the dead person, I'm sorry for what you left behind, what you've lost. Mm. You know, in the spirit of that whimsy, I'd like to put two thoughts into your and other people's heads.
Yeah.
The first one is, can you imagine if this film was remade in America? It would be horrible.
It would be horrible. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
enough said. The other thing is that the actor...
We'll probably have the music in there.
And a whole lot of jokes. And, and yeah, some chaotic chasing of characters through the building. But the other thing I would say is that the actor who played Mr. Watanabe, who was the one who was struggling to find a moment of meaning in his life.
Yes.
Since this film was made, he has died.
Oh, wow.
And I like to think of him being in that space beyond limbo now, having chosen his moment, whether it's the making of this film or something totally different in his life. But I like to think of him being somewhere, having actually gone through that process.
Yeah.
I just like that thought.
Well, look, anything to do with the afterlife, because it's such an unknown, is an amazing thing. And, you know, I think everybody wants to know what's going to happen in the afterlife. It's one of those big things. I think all the people in the afterlife are going, oh, this is what it is. A couple of you were worried.
No, because they've been there and they've gone around again.
Yeah, that's right. So it is a great topic. And like I said, I didn't dislike the film. I liked the concept of the movie. I didn't dislike it.
So out of 10?
I'm going to give it a 6.
And you're going to give it a 6. I just knew.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 6 because I thought I was teetering on the age of 5. Don't worry about it. But I thought if it's just bringing it down to the editing of it and cutting things out, I don't think that's strong enough to give it a 5. I think giving it a 6 is best.
And what do you think I'm going to give it?
I think you're going I don't know. We're going to give it an 8.
No, I'm going to give it a 9.
Oh, wow.
I have to say, this time around, I teetered down towards an 8 because, you know, I did find it a bit slow going at times, like you say, but I'm just so captured by the central idea and the execution of it that it's, you know, look, you know, a Hollywood kind of film could make this much more fantastic, you know, harps and angels or billowing cloaks or the occasional revelation of a wing or something. It's not. It's very deliberately down at heel. And
maybe too down.
I like that. And I really like my self-created meaning, perhaps, of that scene of the moon and what I think that was actually trying to say to us. So I'm hoping that's actually part of the message. If not, I don't care. I'm still running with it.
Yeah.
I find things in this film to carry forward with me. And any film that makes me think about it, not only after I walk out of the cinema or, you know, turn off the DVD player, that stays with me for years after, as this film is done, I think is doing something really powerful.
And I agree with that. I
think you have to be in the right frame of mind to watch it, but I think that's what puts it in the 9 category. But it's not a masterpiece, but it just has something in it that just really resonates with me. And now for our third movie, we're going to talk about Remember Me, or perhaps Remember Me, My Love, an Italian film. And this is where last time I promised that we're going to hear some beautiful Italian pronunciation from Riccardo.
You put the pressure on?
Go for it.
Okay, Remember Me. Directed by Gabriele Muccino, known for American films The Pursuit of Happiness and 7 Pounds with Will Smith, this 2003 film, Remember Me, also known as Ricordate di Me, is a film about the Ristuccias, who on the outside seem like they should be a really happy Italian family, but they're far from it, all silently struggling internally with their lives in different ways. From the father, Carlo, a brilliant Fabrizio Bentivoglio, an aspiring writer stuck in a job he doesn't like, and a seemingly tired marriage to wife Giulia, Laura Morante, an uptight and stressed out literature professor who longs to be an actress again. Then there's son Paolo, the director's brother Silvio Muccino, a teenager who has trouble with asserting himself in front of a girl whom he's attracted to, and finally, ultra-selfish daughter Valentina Nicoletta Romanoff, who will do anything to become a television showgirl. Amongst the family's silence, all their feelings and emotion begin to surface when Carlo begins an affair with an old girlfriend, Monica Bellucci, and as a result, he almost ruins the family balance. Now, when I first saw this film, I marvelled at the way Muccino moved and weaved the camera seamlessly through the story. He directs with such energy and movement. I couldn't keep my eye off it. The performances are so raw and real and utterly believable. Whilst the son and daughter are working out their dreams and desires for the future, Carlo and Julia are struggling with dreams that haven't happened and a love with no spark. Now, some people have criticised the film for being just middle-class problems, but really, why is that an issue? Aren't the middle class allowed to have problems? I find this a pretty silly argument. To me, the film is a heartbreaking look at love on the ropes and how this affects all generations differently. It also tells its audience not to sweat the small stuff, to seek a true balance between personal happiness, love, and ambition. Greg, what did you think of this?
Well, first of all, I just want to let you know that there are women and men out there who are swooning and sighing at some of those pronunciations of yours. It's lovely to hear. I wish I could say this was a lovely film. And I think you guessed that it didn't work for me. It started well. I really liked the start. I liked the narrator's voice telling you this is the neighbourhood, it used to be that,
that's
then
right.
It was that,
yeah.
Now it's this.
Yeah.
Now here's Carlo and Julia. I can't roll my R's, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Not like you can anyway. And even some of the comments, you know, before they wake up, the narrator is saying, beneath them, the mattress, witness to the little that happens between them. It's just a really nice arch kind of observational voice. And it took me probably too long to realise that while the camera is sort of hovering above the marital bed, it's very, very, very slowly zooming in on Carlo. And it took me a while to realise that it wasn't actually the two of them anymore, it was him.
Yeah.
So very subtly, very beautifully, gracefully done.
It is.
And then you have all the chaos in the family. You have the little conspiracies almost between, you know, the father and the son about, you know, don't upset your mother.
Yeah.
And later on there are things going on between the mother and the daughter in similar kinds of ways where they're loggerheads but also in some ways kind of co-conspirators sometimes as well. But I just didn't feel like the film lived up to the promise of the start. So we had the introduction with that narrator voice.
Yes.
The narrator comes back a bit later in the film and then they're gone. So this kind of it is a narrative device.
Yeah, it is.
Starts and it's forgotten. We never find out who the narrator is. And I wouldn't have minded if they had continued throughout. But now I feel like there's this character who's bringing us in and I don't know what their place is in the story.
Oh, I never felt that, actually. I felt the narrator, once you know the characters, once you're in with the story within the first act, it was fine. I was in with the story and I was following it. And then when it came back at the end, it was fine for me. I never sort of thought that
My problem was the story. I thought, as you pointed out in your introduction, I thought the visual treatment, and I really mean here, I think the camera movement, like the early scenes above the beds and moving to the apartment. You've set anything in Rome, and I'm halfway there, but you didn't see a Rome that was beautiful, touristy, romantic Rome.
No, it's not really.
You saw suburban, middle class,
schools
and cafes and
which
parties
is, which is a lovely differential there.
Yeah, so I didn't mind that. I thought the acting, by and large, was really good. It was just the story. I didn't care about the characters. And I'm obviously not going to mount the argument that it's about middle-class problems because I don't want to be silly. But if I cared about the characters, I would have cared more about the problem. But everyone was so self-obsessed. You know, everyone's looking in mirrors all the time. Everyone's looking for external validation, if not from the mirror, by saying to family members and friends, what am I like?
But you're looking at a family life which is seemingly, you know, from the outside, people would look at them and go, oh, wow, they're great. They've got money, they've got, you know, they're happy, they've got a family.
Yeah, but I've seen that before. In that respect, I don't think it does anything new.
Okay. But what it does do, and I think this is really important to show in a movie, is that when Carlo's having an affair with Monica Bellucci, who's just wonderful, you know, she's just awesome and everything.
I'm not a big fan, actually.
But you really see why he's gone that direction. So I think there hasn't been a film I've seen which really points that, you know, yes, he's having an affair, but you look at both sides here and say, well, he's not just the bad guy, that both sides are to blame for this marital affair.
Oh, everyone's to blame because they're so self-obsessed.
Yeah.
And so I just didn't care. And I disagree with one thing in your introduction, and I read something online that said the same kind of thing, which is that, you know, he almost destroys the family balance. Well, I think the end of the film is at worst ambiguous. I think it's pretty clear that this supposed harmony and balance is not going to last very long.
Yeah, it's one part of the film which I just wish it had have just finished with a shot of Carlo. It does finish with your thought of he's just going to go back there. But when Carlo says to Julia, and when she says, "Will you leave? I want you to leave." And he says, "Well, fine." It sort of gives him an excuse to say, "I'm going. See you later."
And she says, "If you leave, you can't come back."
Yeah. But then when he said, when he really is going to leave, she says, "Don't give up everything within a second. You know, like all of what we've had in a moment. Just think about things a little bit." You know, I really felt their passion. I really felt their passion early and why it's got to where it did. There's a lot of blame in there as well for what they've been wanting to do and what they haven't done. I really felt these characters. I really did.
Did you like his writing?
I loved it. I loved this movie.
No. Did you like the book he was writing?
Oh.
I couldn't work out. It didn't particularly strike me.
No, it didn't strike me that
and
much.
And I didn't know it was a translation thing, but I kind of wondered, was the director or the writer saying, "Well, look, in fact, this dream hasn't got much to it." And, you know, he and maybe Monica Bellucci's character, is it Alessandra?
Yeah.
Either they're both reading more into it because he wrote it, or she's just, you know, being supportive.
Mm.
But
when you have Monica Bellucci's character give up her life or her marriage and then wait for him, like, I got all that.
There's a big event that you obviously don't want to refer to. Halfway through the film,
which, it's surprising to me.
It didn't surprise me just before, just before it happened. I thought, I know it's going to happen.
Yeah,
and it's straight out of An Affair to Remember with Deborah Carr and Cary Grant. So it's at least a bit borrowed. I actually don't find Monica Bellucci that interesting.
I thought she's lovely in this.
No, I was much more intrigued by the character of the mother.
Laura Morante is very good in this, I must say. Her stress levels in this movie, I find her quite hard to watch sometimes in this because she's teetering on such a tightrope. She's got a daughter
who's a bitch to her, basically.
Oh, well, Valentina's quite a character.
Oh, yeah, but when she says to her mother, after the father gets out of the car, she very pointedly says, "I don't want to be the failure, but you are."
Yeah.
Slightly different words, but that's what she's saying.
Yeah, she's
quite... While the son just kind of sits in the back.
I find her quite a hard character to watch, Valentina, because she's so self-obsessed. I mean, you say they all are, but I think she's the most self-obsessed of everybody.
Well, I found it difficult to watch for two reasons. That was certainly one of them. The other was when she's doing her little numbers, particularly around the apartment with tight shorts and roller skates. First thing I thought was, I bet this is a male director. I felt very uncomfortable, like I was almost perving on her.
Okay. Come on.
No, I just...
Don't just label that on an Italian director. Come on.
Everything the film was saying about her in the world of middle-aged men of power in the
Tempfield. Did you see the show that she's going to be on? Of course,
Alibaba.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in the apartment too, that's where I felt like, this is the director.
It's her.
It was both. And I just.
That was her costume. I think you're looking at the costume department here.
That's not the costume. It's the squatting down on all the haunches, the loving caresses of her by the camera. It was just. Now I'm sounding like a middle-aged man, which I am. But I just thought.
No.
Oh, really?
I disagree. I disagree. No. Look, I must say, with this film, I love it a lot and I feel every time I see it.
I didn't feel like I didn't have the emotional payoff. And when the film started, as I said, I really thought I was going to be watching an interesting film and the story wasn't there for me. There was nothing.
You mean like the son's story?
My heart broke kind of intellectually for the son.
Mm.
You know, he was kind of the lost soul in the middle of this quartet. Yeah. He, as you said in the introduction, he was trying to define himself. I think he was much more than the daughter. He was trying to define himself, going in a direction, in love with this girl, and it all falls apart. So he goes for something a lot more shallow.
Yeah.
And at the point when he tries to engage his father in a deep conversation about, you know, are you seeing someone else? And the father chooses to lie at that point.
Yeah.
When it's all pretty much on the table.
Yeah.
Just makes you wonder, what kind of relationship does he have with his dad?
Mm.
Now, you know, when you're a father and you have an adult or, you know, a teen son, you're not going to tell them anything in your past.
Yeah.
But that was a moment when it was just screaming for some truth-telling.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I just didn't care for the characters. No one was nice or kind.
Well, it's interesting because Carlo, as the father, It's amazing because he was quite loved. He's quite a liked character. I mean, when he goes to the party,
everyone's glad to
Everybody's glad to see him. Yeah. They're all very glad
to see him. Got a beautiful head of hair.
Yeah, he does. And it was just so happy to see him. So he's very liked by everybody. And when he goes home, he's just not a happy camper. And I think marriages can get that way. There is something to be said for looking at a relationship in that way, which is tired.
I got all that intellectually, but I didn't feel anything for this film. There's a film I'd like us to review one day, which I really like, which is The Ice Storm.
Oh, yeah.
Around the same time, maybe a bit earlier, Ang Lee in America, but looks at a group of very self-obsessed people in the 70s and some of the people such as the young Elijah Wood who are damaged by the self-obsession of these and, you know, pleasure-seeking of the adults. I find that a much stronger film. I just didn't feel it here.
See, I think this is a lot stronger. I was just moved by this a lot when I first saw it, and even now. And I thought, yeah, I wonder if it's dated on me, but it hasn't.
I think the thing that really let me down at the start of the film was the title. So the title is Ricordati di me, which I assume is Italian for Riccardo and me. So I thought this was going to be our biographies, and it just wasn't there. And when his boss was called Riccardo, I thought, oh, this is where it starts, but it just wasn't. And I waited the entire film for a character called Greg or Gregorio or something, and I just felt really disenfranchised.
Yeah.
More seriously, the other thing about this was the subtitles.
Mm.
So when the father gets out of the car and everyone's saying ciao, and it quite clearly they're saying goodbye to him, and the subtitles say hi. Early in the film, that made me distrust, like I said last season about the bicycle thieves.
Yeah, the subtitles
made me distrust how much I was hearing. So I feel like I say this a bit, but you know, sometimes you really get into a film and I don't. And I find reasons for it, like, you know, the audition scenes from Salaam Cinema. Yeah. That's your world, not mine.
Yeah.
And I don't want this to be an easy out. But for this film, possibly, you're getting more out of it because you understand the Italian.
Yeah.
And I'm going by the translation, which I'm a bit suspicious of.
Mm.
But unless there was a lot of stuff that I just wasn't coming through, I felt distance from it. Mm. And I just, the opening of it, I just really felt, ooh, this is going to be interesting. I know Riccardo likes this film. This is a strong start. I am intrigued. The shot's really interesting. And the camera work was good, I think, all the way through.
Well, it's different.
It was the story.
It moves fluidly because it's very structured shots and everything like that. It's not handheld here a lot of the time. It's very structured sort of tracking shots or whatnot. The camera moves fluidly. But, you know, I also love the wife's story, Julia's story, with her in the theatre and trying to act, which made me cringe.
That was the most interesting. As an actor?
Yeah, as an actor. It just makes me cringe just thinking about her, forgetting her lines. I mean, if you forget your lines on stage once, it's so horrific, you'll never get over it. It's something which stays with you. It really does. I know actors, it hasn't happened to me at all, actually. I never forget my lines. But I know actors who it has happened to, if once, just once. And it's so horrific that they just lose so much confidence. They're just afraid that it's going to happen again. It is quite nerve-wracking.
No, I believe that.
And her getting back into the theatre and, you know, frustrating some of the cast and whatnot, but the director believing in her, all of her, you know, insecurities with the director. I mean,
who she thinks she's falling in love with.
Yeah, yeah.
Until.
Yeah.
Dot, dot, dot.
Well, what are you going to give this?
A 6.
Okay.
Which I promise I thought of before we sat down. It's not because that's what you gave to Afterlife. So for me, it generally is
for revenge.
I'm trying to avoid that concept. I would at least serve it cold. I'd wait a few episodes and then stick the knife in. So that might be coming later. So stay tuned, folks.
Yeah.
Look, it's a 6, as I say. It was well acted. It was well filmed. It, you know, had interesting moments in it. But I didn't care about the characters, and so I wasn't interested in their story.
Well, I'm giving it an 8. When a movie does move me that much, and I can watch it again and just...
So how many times have you watched this film?
About 5.
And you've been moved every time?
Every time.
Why is it only an 8?
It's different. There's classics and there's classics. It's just because I like it so much. I don't think I wouldn't call it a classic film.
Yeah.
And that's why I give it an 8. I wouldn't give it a 9 either. But I think an 8 is still very, very good.
Yes.
And is a favourite. But no, it's definitely, I would not put it into the realm of, say, you know, a 10, which is like It's a Wonderful Life, a classics,
yeah,
like that. You know, it's an enjoyable film, which I like, and it's one which, you know, I think, you know, as you've obviously seen, not liked as much. So, no, definitely something wrong with classics. I would never go above that. So thanks for listening to episode 9, season 2 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast.
Which we said we were calling Love and the Great Hereafter. Mm. And that's because, as we hope you've discovered across this episode, we've really touched on the big themes: love, marriage, family, and death.
Mm.
And I think there's something in there for all of us.
I think there is too.
I think there is. Yes.
I think all three films are definitely watchable, and you should see them. They're, yeah.
Just don't watch Afterlife when you're tired.
No, please don't. Please do not. So next episode, which is our final episode for season two. Yeah, which is quite amazing. We thought we'd go something a bit more lighthearted. So. Yes. We've called it 21st Century Playground.
And basically what we're covering next time is to look at some of the storytelling mechanisms that we enjoyed as children, puppets and animation, but using them to look at stories and themes for grown-ups that have meatier kind of topics. And sometimes rude content as well. Ricardo, what are we going to do?
Okay, the first film we're going to be looking at is the 2003 film The Triplets of Belleville.
Which you haven't seen, but I have.
I haven't seen it, no.
Yep. And then?
Second film we're looking at is the 2015 film Annalisa.
Which neither of us has seen.
Haven't seen that. And then we're looking at a favourite, Team America World Police, a 2004 film.
Which we have both seen.
Yeah.
And just so you know, that's the rude one. Yeah. Well, we don't know about the other two, or Anomalisa certainly, but Team America, make sure the kids are safely in bed.
And that's quite a fun one to finish on. Anyway, for season two. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.
A bientôt.